court is ready to hear argument in 070783, Marks v. St. Luke's Episcopal Hospital.
May it please the court, Ms. Hosel will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The case before the court today began in this case of bed in which Irving Marks was sitting on in St. Luke's Hospital in March of 2000. And in order to rise from the bed, his footboard pushed himself into a standing position, and the footboard fell off the bed, crashed to the floor, and sustaining serious injuries. This bed was not medically prescribed for Marks. There's no medical judgment or professional judgment involved in the assembly of the bed, in its inspection or maintenance or its use, and there's certainly no professional medical judgment involved in the footboard, which is the part that broke.
So to determine if it's a medical liability claim, do we look at each specific allegation, or do we look at the nature of the underlying claim? And what does the court mean in diverse care when it says court's not bound by what the allegations are? You look to the underlying claim.
Court means, Your Honor, is that it's not the words used in the original petition that will determine the nature of the claim. The court looks to the underlying claim, meaning it looks to the facts alleged, the type of breach alleged, and it's looking specifically for two things. Whether or not, one, the claims assert a breach of a standard of care specially or specifically applicable to the healthcare industry, as this court held in Sirokolik versus Rhodes, and two, whether or not the act or omission complained of is inseparable from the rendition of medical care to that plaintiff.
If you talk about improper training, improper supervision, improper assembly or an instruction on how to assemble this particular piece of equipment, does that in itself invoke this medical liability claim?
No, Your Honor, it does not. What we're talking about in this petition, as you recognize, are claims relating to the construction of the piece of furniture. It is not something that requires medical judgment or expertise. It is a standard of care, duty of ordinary care, that the general public is more than able to understand.
But how you put failing to properly train staff to prevent and protect patients from falls, failing to train your nurses and med techs, that's got to be health care.
Not in this case, Your Honor. The section of the petition that you're referring to can't be read in isolation. Again, you're not looking at the words used. You're looking at the underlying nature of this claim. That claim...
Well, I mean, how are you going to prove that at trial? You're going to call a nurse expert to say they should have trained them and supervised? What's that proof going to be?
That exactly is the issue. In this case, there is...
No. You're the plaintiff's attorney. What's the proof going to be?
The proof is going to be an ordinary care of building furniture doesn't require expert testimony. It is a duty or a negligence standard that the general public understands.
So you're not going to have any nursing experts?
In the claims that were asserted in the original petition, no healthcare liability claims were asserted. So, no, there was no requirement under those claims to have an expert.
And my question is, are you going to have a nursing expert? Can you assure us today you're not calling any nursing experts at trial?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. This petition was amended numerous
absolutely
times.
Absolutely not? You're not going to call them?
Yes, there will be experts called because this petition was amended prior, long before it was dismissed, and later did assert healthcare liability claims, which will require expert testimony. The claims in this appeal, however, are only those asserted in the original petition, not those health care liability claims that were asserted in the second amended petition a year later. So the claims in the original petition relate solely to the fact that the footboard fell off this bed. And because there's no professional judgment...
Tell me about the amended petition. Is that after an interlocutory appeal? You amended the petition to add health care claims. Has expert report been filed on them?
No, Your Honor, let me clarify. The petition was amended several times. The first amended petition was about 4 or 5 weeks after the original petition, and it followed correspondence from the respondents who sent draft special exceptions to Marx's counsel, and in those special exceptions said, we realize that you asserted general claims of ordinary negligence and you did not assert a claim under the Healthcare Liability Act, 4590I. But they weren't sure. Even though they knew that they had not been asserted, no health care liability claims had been asserted in the original petition. To make it absolutely clear, Marks amended his original petition shortly after that filing and, again, made that language crystal clear, asserting duty of ordinary care, just as it said in the original petition, general negligence claims, and premises liability claims, all based on the facts alleged, which is that the footboard fell off the bed. After another year, after discovery was taken, after more information about the case was gathered in May of 2003, a year later, the second amended petition was filed, and in that petition for the first time were claims regarding the nursing care and monitoring and the general medical treatment for Mr. Marks.
Well, I'm looking at what appears to be a reproduction of the original petition that alleges a failure to properly train others, including nursing staff. Isn't that, and you're saying that that's not in the original?
That is in the original petition, sir.
And that's what we're here about today.
Yes, just the original petition. It was only the claims in the original petition that were the basis of the motion to dismiss and the trial court's order. But again, you must look at these claims in the context of the facts alleged, the breaches alleged, as the first court of appeals did correctly when it heard this case for the first time.
Well, let's say you got four allegations in the original petition. Three of them appear to be clearly health care liability claims. The fourth one, wrongful assembly of a bed. It's a negligence claim. Why can't that be severed and segregated from the rest and let that cause of action go forward? And I think that's what Justice Jennings said in his dissent.
That is what Justice Jennings said in his dissent. However, those first three causes of action are not health care liability claims.
But if you're wrong, if you're wrong and for whatever reason, does your entire claim fail or can those claims be severed and the case be sent back for the last issue on premises liability or negligence in assembly of this bed be tried?
If that were the holding of this court, yes, they could be severed. However, again, those first three claims are not read in isolation. The supervision, monitoring type language there all centers on the duty of the hospital in relating to the assembly of furniture, the bed, not supervision and monitoring in the health care being provided to the patient.
And if you're right, that seems to be at odds with DiversiCare.
DiversiCare is quite very distinguishable on a couple of points. First of all, DiversiCare talked about supervision and monitoring of the patients in the nursing home. DiversiCare wasn't about a broken piece of furniture. It wasn't about, as this court recognized, a rickety staircase, an open window, a door that fell on somebody, a ceiling tile that fell on somebody. It was about whether or not professional medical judgments had been appropriately made regarding the care and supervision of the patients to protect them from each other. In addition, the court recognized that those judgments are statutorily regulated for the nursing home. There is no regulation, and certainly none in this record, for the assembly, maintenance, inspection, building of a bed. There's no special regulation. There's no special standard of care in the healthcare industry for the footboard on this bed.
Well, it's a very troubling area and a lot of confusion and disagreement over it, but the fact of the matter is that the definition of healthcare liability claim includes matters related to safety, which is what the issue came up in DiversiCare. And it seems to me that if you're in a hospital, if a part of a bed breaks off injuring a party, that's a safety issue, is it not?
It is a safety issue, but not a safety issue in this definition, including any and every kind of safety-related matter.
And why is it not? Let me ask you just along those lines, and I didn't mean to interrupt Justice Green, but could you read that statute to say healthcare liability claim means a claim departure from accepted standards of safety which proximately results in injury or death of the patient?
You could read that way, Your Honor, but it still does not mean that any safety claim goes, because in reading the statute, the analysis does not end with reading the word safety.
And what part of the statute says you don't end at safety?
First, the Code Construction Act tells us that we read provisions in context, in harmony with the entire statute, and certainly in context with the legislative intent. This court itself held that when there's an undefined term, and in this case safety is undefined in the statute, it is not construed in isolation. It must be construed in harmony with the rest of this provision, the rest of the statute. Section 1.02 of the statute lays out very clearly the legislature's intent here, twofold, as we all know. To reduce the number of frivolous medical malpractice claims which the legislature determined were responsible for driving up the cost of malpractice insurance. In order to achieve that goal, they instituted the procedural requirements and limitations of the statute. But it was also their express intent to do these, to impose these limitations only to the extent necessary to address that crisis. And in Section 1.02, lay out very clearly that they are not intending to extend the restrictions of the statute to any other area of Texas legal system or tort law. Tort law, in this case, is about general negligence in a piece of furniture. That is the tort law that the legislature intended to exclude from the statute. Claims about a broken bed do not affect, are not the kind of claims that statute was intended to address. They aren't the claims that fall under malpractice coverage. The Fifth Circuit actually just released a new opinion which discusses this court's holding in DiversiCare, and it acknowledges this interplay between commercial general liability policies and professional malpractice policies in a hospital. And the commercial general liability policies are for non-care-related liability claims. The professional policies are care-related, basing that decision, that distinction, on this court's analysis of the statute in DiversiCare versus Rubio.
You know, it just seems to me that this is either a health care liability claim or it's not. It's just black and white, that simple. What was the purpose of amending the complaint?
The first amendment of the complaint?
Any amendment, and then to assert the health care liability claim.
The first amendment was...
Is it in response to a motion to dismiss? Or is it because, well, now I really think I have a health care liability claim on some other issues?
No, the petition started out based on the facts known at the time, which is that the bed broke. After discovery, additional information was gathered from the hospital, from records, and claims were added. It was months later, after all the amended petitions were filed, it was 18 months later that St. Luke's filed the motion to dismiss. After a year and a half of discovery battles, after joint motions to continue the case, it was only on the eve of trial in January of 2004, 2 years almost after the filing of this case, that the motion to dismiss was filed. So
which,
all those amendments...
Which you used to be able to do.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not saying that they were not entitled to wait at that time, but I think the delay and the fact that, again, 18 months of discovery and motion practice and battles, certainly indicative of the position that we take today, that given the clear nature of the ordinary duty asserted in the original petition, the communication from those draft special exceptions where St. Luke said, yes, we know. You just said, you know, ordinary duty.
I'm just wondering if that cuts too fine a line. If, you know, if somebody dies in an operation, can you, you know, 2 years comes up, you don't have an expert yet, can you file a suit saying, well, we're suing for defective pajamas?
Well, that would be
and
clearly
then get an
frivolous.
Expert, and then get an expert, and a year later amend to say, oh, and now that we've done the discovery, we're also suing for the surgery, and here's our expert report. That would defeat the whole purpose of the statute, wouldn't it?
That could, and that example is frivolous in terms of pajamas, but the facts in this case are undisputed.
If I was a better plaintiff's attorney, I could have come up with a better example.
There's no dispute as to the facts of this case. Footboard fell off the bed. It is admitted as well that
I know, but
that's what happened.
You know, people are creative.
Yes, they are creative.
And people are going to be able, in almost any medical malpractice case, they're going to be able to imagine something they can plead. They don't really want to go to the jury. Remember, I don't want to go to the jury on it. I just want to delay giving the expert report.
Well, you know.
And isn't that what you're arguing for?
No, Your Honor. This was not a frivolous claim. It's filed to buy time until we could come up with a health care claim.
Look, it's in the insurance world, sometimes a plaintiff can artfully plead themselves out of coverage. And it seems to me that the way these facts are is that for whatever reason, you may have pled yourself out of a live and potential viable claim if the statute is read that you put all these claims together, and if two or three of them seem like a health care liability claim, you throw them all out. I mean, that certainly doesn't seem to be equitable.
That would only be true, Your Honor, if this court holds that the safety standard, the only basis on which the First Court of Appeals affirmed the dismissal of this case, is read to include broken furniture. Is
well,
read
a
to be that
bed way. Is a specialized piece of medical equipment, is it not? Or
no, it's not, especially on this record. There's absolutely
nothing. Hospitals don't go to rooms to go to furnish their hospital rooms. This is a specialized piece of equipment.
There's no evidence in this record that it's specialized. But even if there were, if I may answer the question.
Complete your thought.
It was the footboard that broke. It wasn't a specialized piece like the trapeze lifting device in Espinoza. It was a bed that Mark slept in. Like the bed in Chris's health business.
And he had back surgery, and isn't a bed, if you have back surgery especially, part of the recovery, part of the recuperation process after back surgery?
It was not ordered that way in this case. I can certainly see that people would want to lay in a bed after surgery. It was not medically required, not medically described. No order for that in this record. It was, again, the place he slept in.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. David L. will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, let me start, if I can, with Justice Medina's question about severance. There's no need to sever it. The fourth claim all by itself, even if you consider it all by itself, is a medical malpractice claim. It's a health care liability claim under Texas law.
What's the affidavit going to say? Who's it going to be from, and what's it going to say?
The affidavit.
Expert report.
I think it'll probably say most of what Mr. Mark's expert already said. Dr. Rubin is an orthopedic surgeon, and he listed a bunch of 12 or 13 different things that a hospital is supposed to look at to evaluate or assess a patient for his risk to fall. You know, what's he in the hospital for the first place?
What kind of expert report are you going to get about the attachment of the footboard to the bed?
I think, again, what Dr. Rubin said, which is that providing a hospital bed is part of a health care standard. It's part of what the hospital owes.
Who's going to state the standard of care for footboard attachment?
I don't know that it's appropriate to parse it that thinly, as you said in the previous case. A footboard, I mean, you could talk about, was the sheet not properly on the bed? Was the wheel of the hospital bed turned?
His wife, if Mark's wife had been there visiting him and had leaned on the bed and had fallen off and she had hurt herself, would that be a health care liability claim?
No, because she's not a patient. And there's a couple of cases about that in Texas, which we've cited. A visitor in a hospital waiting room fell off the chair. Nobody even suggested that was a health care claim. There's another one, I think, out of Dallas where a patient's husband was on one of those contraptions, those fold-out chair beds, and hurt himself, and nobody suggested it was a health care claim because he wasn't a patient.
I still don't understand who's going to – when you say you can't parse it that thin, that is the allegation in this case. That the footboard fell off, it was negligently attached, a premises claim. That's the whole claim here. And so it doesn't seem parsing it thin to ask what sort of expert is going to opine in terms of the attachment of the footboard to the bed.
Well, I don't think it's the whole allegation, and as my opponent
counsel presume with me that it is.
If that was simply the allegation, I still think it goes into safety of what's provided to a post-operative hospital inpatient recovering from back surgery. Now, I don't know. I mean, in any case, you might have several experts talking about something, and I don't know that, for instance, the orthopedic surgeon who did his back surgery, or perhaps a neurosurgeon, I'm not sure, I don't know that person would know how exactly you put a footboard on, same as that person probably wouldn't know what sheets you use on a bed in a particular situation.
That's precisely right. If they don't know, then it's not a health liability claim. If they had no training, it's not. It's simply premises liability claim.
But
in your scenario, there would never be a cause of action against a hospital provider to a patient.
In the first situation, I'm sorry?
Any scenario you talked about. You just said that if they're a patient and an equipment fails, even if it's assembled defectively or incorrectly, it still falls under the Health Care Liability Claim Act, and there's no cause of action. How can that be so?
I think it is. It falls under the Health Care Liability Act. I think there would be a cause of action. Maybe I'm not understanding the question correctly.
But you'd have to get an expert to come in, like a furniture repair expert, to describe how this chair or this bed or this device. Well, you can get hurt in a lot of different ways in the hospital. And if a patient gets hurt on those things, you've got to find an expert that says, well, this is what was wrong with that chair.
You may not. And that's
the direction where we seem to be going with these kinds of cases.
In 2005, in Murphy versus Russell, the court explained a little bit about the difference between the expert report requirement under the former statute, Article 4590I, and the difference between that and expert testimony at trial. And the court said the expert report requirement is procedural. It is basically a blessing, an affirmation by a qualified and knowledgeable member of the healthcare community that this particular claim may have enough merit to get off the ground, but they wouldn't necessarily need expert testimony at trial.
Oh, I know that. The expert report. A patient sits down in a chair and the chair falls apart. Well, under this statute, the way it seems to be written and under the DiversiCare standard that we're going, it seems to me that you would in order to maintain this lawsuit, you've got to file an expert report. Now, who does it come from? It can't come from a nurse. A nurse doesn't know how to fix furniture or how furniture is repaired. So do you just go out and find a furniture salesman to come in and keep your health care liability claim alive?
No, I don't think so. And I would point out, in their original petition, on the broken bed claim, they actually do talk about nurses. And so just looked at the actual plain language of their petition, I mean, they talked about engineering staff and maintenance staff and nursing staff. But no, I don't know that. I think what my opposing counsel said is right. You have to look at the petition as a whole. And when you are.
First care says you're not bound. We're not bound to just look at that. We can look at the underlying cause of action. And if it's our view that it's a premises liability claim, why can't that be correct? Right?
Yeah, I mean, if
you can't have it both ways.
I think that the inclusion of safety in 4590I, and this is what Chief Justice Jefferson was saying in his concurrence, that safety captures both concepts. It captures a premises liability claim in certain situations in a healthcare provider or a hospital, and it also captures medical malpractice. It's probably unique.
But that was a concurrence, and I know that in the majority opinion they referred to rickety stairs and an unlocked window. How would this be different from rickety stairs if he had been injured on rickety stairs?
If he had been injured on rickety stairs, I don't think. I mean, there may be an argument, and I'm sure, again, a more skilled plaintiff's lawyer than I could do it, there may be an argument that a hospital has this general supervisory role to take care of all of its patients all the time. And so if they're walking down the staircase, then they need to take care of them. I think that the line, there may need to be a line drawn for safety. I don't think it needs to be drawn in this case.
The rickety staircase reference was to the healthcare portion of the statute and that definition. The safety portion, however, tended to, as I read it, track a lot of what the Chief's concurrence was. Is it your view that safety is not limited by accepted standards, the language that's in the other part of the provision?
Frankly, yes. I agree. I agreed with the majority opinion that safety we should be used in its ordinary context, which is what the legislature told us to do for undefined terms. I believe that there is nothing in the context of 4590I that limits it, and I think it means not exposed to danger.
So whereas a healthcare liability or a healthcare claim needs to have some connection to medical care treatment, safety, as you read the statute, broadly covers anything that may impact the, to use the term again, safety of the patient. Is that too broad, or do you believe it's that broad?
I think it certainly can be read and construed that broadly. And again, I don't think that today or this case is the case where you have to make that distinction, because a hospital bed, an allegedly broken hospital bed, no matter how tightly you connect health care and safety, no matter how narrowly it's construed, I think a hospital bed fits within that definition.
Maybe it does, but what about the ineffective or defective assembly of the hospital bed by anyone? Certainly when assembled by a doctor. I doubt if it was assembled by a nurse. So how does the negligent assembly of a hospital bed fall under the act? I don't understand that. Explain it to me.
I think it has to fall under both health care and safety. The assembly of the bed is how Let me start over. The statute talks about safety in healthcare. It doesn't define precisely. Is it safety from drugs, safety from humans, safety from equipment? It doesn't go into that at all. It simply says safety. So I think assembly, I think maintenance, I think what kind of material is used for the bed, I think, you know, solvents you use to clean the metal on the bed, I think that all falls under both the definitions of safety and healthcare, because a working hospital bed in all of its components and all of its part is an inseparable part of the healthcare services rendered to a post-operative hospital inpatient, particularly one who has a catheter, a pain pump in his spine.
What if I have back surgery and I order or the doctor prescribes a hospital bed in my house, and I get hurt on that hospital bed? Is that a healthcare liability claim?
Probably. I believe it is. I mean, it's a hospital bed. It was inseparable from the care provided, whether it was provided in the hospital or out of the hospital. It's still hospital.
What if it's a hospital bed and I have it just because I want it? Because I like what it does. It makes me sleep better.
Who would you be suing?
Well, that's my question. Say that, you know, I get hurt on the bed. Do I sue the bed manufacturer? And if I do, is that a healthcare claim or not?
It's not, because the bed manufacturer is not a healthcare provider. But if you were to, if it's
in a hospital, that's different.
If it's in a hospital and you're alleging that the hospital was negligent for whatever reason, either in failing to take care of you through its nurses or failing to put your bed together correctly, then it is a healthcare liability claim.
What about these little chairs that you see advertised on TV? A doctor prescribes that, and so a patient that just can't get around like they used to get around uses one of these chairs and falls off of it because a wheel comes off. What kind of claim is that?
I think it would depend on the facts. I mean, if a doctor...
Well, the facts is that was prescribed. Patient bought it and is using it. So the manufacturer and the service provider are all immune from litigation because it was prescribed by a doctor?
No, I don't think they're immune from it. I think just the claims against those defendants would not be healthcare liability claims. I'm not sure if it would have to be severed out, if they'd have to have separate trials because of the different procedural hurdles or anything like that. But, I mean, a claim against...
Be okay in that scenario to sever out the claim?
I know that, I mean, there can't be a healthcare liability claim against someone who's not a healthcare provider. It may be that a manufacturer of these specialized medical devices, perhaps under some definition, it could be considered a healthcare provider. I'm not sure about that. But if it's not a claim against a healthcare provider, then it's not a healthcare liability claim.
And no one sued the manufacturer in this case. They've sued a hospital.
That's right.
And your hospital, I presume, has procedures about cleaning, maintenance, and all of that are subject to inspection by the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation. They inspect all that stuff, don't they?
I would presume so, yes.
Okay.
Could you tell me, I'm having a problem with understanding the logic in a rule that anyone who's visiting him in the hospital who is injured by leaning on this bed can sue the hospital, but the patient can't.
Well, they can both sue the hospital. It's just that they would be subject to different procedural requirements.
But explain to me the logic behind that.
The logic, I think, we would have to ask the legislature in 4590I. I mean, that's what
they've said.
You agree
it doesn't appear logical. In this instance, when you've got a premises liability claim that anybody else but the patient could bring it without filing an expert report, there's not much logic in that I can find, and if you can offer some, I'd like to hear.
No, I mean, I think that it goes back to the policy of the Healthcare Liability Act and, you know, what was going on in the state in the 70s.
The healthcare liability crisis was because patients were suing instead of third parties.
Right.
Probably.
Right.
Let me ask you this slightly different direction and how this is going to play out. If a court were to hold against you in this case, say, well, no, this is just failed to assemble it right, and assembling it right is not healthcare or safety. So, okay, so we go down to trial. But as things go along, the plaintiffs decide they think they also want to blame the nurses or the med techs for not checking it ever so often to make sure it was right. And argue that the hospital should have gotten more expensive footboards which sounds like an allocation of health care dollars. In other words, it starts to morph into a health care liability claim. What objection could a defendant raise then to say, no, wait a second, you said it was only assembly?
That's a very good question. I mean, they have their second amended petition, and a little bit of background is...
So all you need to do is plead something to get by the health care claim, and then you can morph it later on.
I mean, I worry that's where it would go, and it's akin to removal.
Because there's nothing in 74351 that says you can't amend your petition later.
Right, right, or in 4590I, which
limits it to what you pled the first instance.
Yeah, I mean, in the removal context, just to make an analogy, there's a certain provision that basically if you can not display the grounds for federal subject matter jurisdiction until a certain deadline is passed, then the defendant's out of luck, no matter how clear it is.
The statute has changed, is that right, so that now safety has to be directly related to health care?
Well, that is what the words say. As I read it from some of the new Court of Appeals opinion, there's still some debate about exactly what...
You're not convinced.
I haven't studied it carefully enough.
Let me take my concurrence to the extreme. And the patient is in the hospital bed, and a live wire falls from the ceiling and electrocutes the patient. Is that a healthcare liability claim because it has to do with safety?
If they were alleging that the nurses should have been watching him or something.
No, they're not alleging that.
No,
they're just it's a patient in a hospital bed who's electrocuted because a wire falls down from the ceiling. Is that a healthcare liability claim under, the extreme, if you took my concurrence that says when you read what the statute says, it says the standards of care, relating to safety.
Yeah. So under your concurrence, yes.
And they're suing the hospital.
Right.
I'm sorry?
And they're suing the hospital, not
yes.
a contractor.
And
yes.
Does that make sense, or do we look at the Code Construction Act to the purpose of the statute to begin with to prevent frivolous claims? I mean, does that really make sense, or is that just how you read it because that's what the words say?
Well, I mean, I think you look at the purpose of not just the Healthcare Liability Act, but the purpose of healthcare is to protect patients. And similarly, that in Rubio, nursing home patients are particularly vulnerable and they need sort of extra services, perhaps that a 25-year-old in the hospital for an appendectomy necessarily wouldn't need. I do think that hospital inpatients need different kinds of services and different levels of protection than someone just going to their doctor's office, for instance. And so, I wouldn't be prepared to say that a live wire falling down wouldn't be a safety claim under the healthcare liability claim, not just because that safety doesn't have an express limitation in the statute, but because they're in a hospital and recovering because they can't take care of themselves.
If you read safety like that, you really don't need any of the other words, do you, to define what a health care liability claim is? I mean, there's unsafe treatment, there's unsafe operations, there's unsafe post-operation treatment, there's getting in a wheelchair, out of a wheelchair. In essence, safety might be read just mean anything that happens while you're under care.
Yeah, I think in that case, there could be an argument that health care, for instance, would be sort of superfluous, or medical care, because if you give someone the wrong drug, clear, typical, traditional medical malpractice, the wrong drug is generally going to be unsafe for the body system. By the same token, though, I think that if you don't read safety broadly, then it's superfluous, because if safety has to mean safety related to health care, then why wouldn't it just be a claim about health care? So it's got to be something.
Looking at the
broader
language, is it safety or is it accepted medical standards of safety?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the beginning?
I'm looking at the definition of a healthcare claim. Do you have it in front of you?
Yes, I do. Get it. Make sure I have
departure from accepted medical standards of medical care or health care or safety. And of course, it's always unclear, at least in this case, what modifies what, but could it not simply be accepted medical standards of safety, where the notion of safety is cabined a little bit by the earlier language of medical standards of medical care, medical standards of health care, medical standards of safety?
This will be embarrassing if I don't have the right word, but my statute just says accepted standards of medical care or health care or safety. And so the medical care just modifies care, and health just modifies care and safety.
Okay, what I'm reading is different. Maybe what I have is off base.
Okay, well, let me check, and if there's a problem, I will remedy it.
Well, let me ask you this, too. Looking at the original petition, because it talks about, as we just talked about, safety in the definition of a claim, and you're looking at the cause of action in the original petition by failing to, and I can imagine what you're going to say, by failing to provide Mr. Marks with a safe environment in which to receive treatment and recover.
Yeah, that his whole claim is that the bed was necessary for his safe environment, that the nurses looking in on him and making sure that he was safe for whatever reason, falling out of his bed, not being comfortable, whatever, was his original claim. And so you can't look at the bed claim simply in isolation. But even if you were to, it independently is inseparable from standards of health care and standards of safety, no matter how broadly or how narrowly you construe safety. I don't know that the court has any issues at all about the grace period issue in this case. Petitioner didn't get a chance to talk about it, but I will say that there was no abuse of discretion in denying grace period. Of course, you only get to it if you find that the claim is a health care liability claim, which it is, either independently or in the aggregate. We would stand, obviously, in our brief on that. And unless the court has any other questions, I'll sit down.
No further questions. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you for your time.
Well, you've done discovery in this. You said there was a lot of discovery. Did the hospital have any procedures or rules about inspecting its the beds and the facilities in the hospital and providing maintenance?
Your Honor, what's in the record is very sparse in that area. In response to certain discovery questions in that area, and this is in the second supplemental record, the hospital said that there were no special standards of care, no special procedures relating to the beds. They're just part of, general, everybody observes them, and they're part of a general maintenance scheme. So there haven't been presented any specific hospital policies or standards relating to that inspection, and certainly there's nothing in the record to sustain that. I'd like to address, if I may, to the court, a couple of, I think, key issues here. First of all, many of our questions today have talked about the healthcare section of the definition of healthcare liability claim, medical care, healthcare, or departure from a standard of safety. The first Court of Appeals opinion only found that the claims were healthcare liability claims because they alleged a departure from a standard of safety. It did not find that they were healthcare claims.
I'm a little confused about the procedural posture of the case, but the case as it now stands does involve healthcare claims?
Yes, it does. And
they're out of the same incident, the same fall?
Out of the same set of events, yes, Your Honor.
So your position is that those events can and do give rise to healthcare liability claims?
No, not quite, Your Honor. The original petition claims, again, concern the hospital's duty of care in providing furniture that works, footboards that don't break. The Second Amendment petition added claims for the responsibility of the nurses and doctors in performing their specialized duty of care towards the patient.
With respect to the fall or not?
With respect to the fall, with respect to the response to the fall, with respect to the treatment.
I'm just trying to get at one thing, and that is, does the fall, which you say gives rise to a non-healthcare liability claim, also give rise to a healthcare liability claim in your view?
Not quite, Your Honor. The broken footboard gives rise to an ordinary duty claim. The nurse's responses to the treatment of Mr. Marks gave rise to a healthcare liability claim. It's not the fall.
It was a treatment after their fall? Because I just still don't understand how it can be both.
Well, let me ask, is it my understanding of the record that, and I think this goes to Justice Medina's question, was that there was no response to the fall for an hour or so or some extended period of time after the fall?
The record is not clear on that, as you said. There was some response to the fall. After the fall, Mr. Marks was discharged from the hospital less than 48 hours later, and within a couple of days, he was back at Methodist, unable to breathe, unable to move his arms, severely injured. So there is an issue as to his treatment. There's also an issue as to, as was mentioned, some of the fall precautions that were part of the nurse's duty of care, but none of those precautions involve assembling the bed, doing routine maintenance on the bed.
Back to my question to opposing counsel. Can you, if all of that's involved, but you only file the non-healthcare, non-safety part, and then you wait a year and do a bunch of discovery, and then you add your healthcare claims and, I suppose, send an expert report, doesn't that defeat the statute?
No, Your Honor.
Won't everybody do that? Everybody who can't come up with a report in 120 days, they just plead something else and then add it later.
That is certainly a concern of the courts. But in this case, the facts and the claims originally pled were not claims about the nurse's conduct in providing health care. The nurses, as was mentioned, were simply identified as, along with other employees.
Were they filed outside the limitations period?
No, everything was filed within a two-year limitation period.
Included all the amendments and new stuff?
No, sir. The original petition was filed within the two-year amended period.
Right. So all your amended stuff, you're arguing to the court it's not barred by limitations because it's related to the same, arises from the same transaction or occurrence, because you have to. But then for purposes of the expert report, you're saying, oh, no, it's different transaction occurrence.
Well, I think that...
Like that's both ways.
Your Honor, I think the issue you raised earlier is there are two kinds of standards going on here, and nothing in 4590I eliminates the duty of ordinary care that a hospital owes to its patients.
I agree with that. But nothing in the statute suggests, well, look, just plead something that's not health care, wait for a year or two, then plead the health care part and add the report. That would defeat the whole purpose of the statute, would it not?
No, Your Honor. The facts that were known when the original petition was filed was that a bed broke. There were no facts known at that time on which to base a health care liability claim. That came after discovery revealed those facts. And under the Pulse case that was valid for 4590I, that kind of amendment is appropriate. And when that amendment was added, reports were timely filed. And in my few remaining seconds, I'd like to remind the court that when we're talking now about the posture of this case, the claims that were health care liability claims had reports filed. There's no argument as to those reports. They're there already. And my time is run, I believe. And if there are any further questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Are there any further questions? Justice Flamer.
Mayor, Chief. In your initial petition, you assert that there's a failure to train and supervise nursing staff in caring for Mr. Marks to prevent and protect him from falls and injuries. What training should the nurses have been given?
Same training that the hospital gives to everybody and its employee, the training to exercise their duty of ordinary care to make sure that doors aren't falling off their hinges, sinks aren't falling off
case,
the door. In this case,
what
if they
training
had
should the nurses have been given to care for Mr. Marks to prevent and protect him from injury?
They should have had the same training that the maintenance staff and the tech staff.
I said that. I'm
right.
Specific as to the nurses.
To look
specific
at the bed.
Specific as to Mr. Marks and specific as to the bed, this bed.
To look at the bed and determine if there was a problem with it. But that's not a medical standard of care. And, in fact, the nurses testified that wasn't their duty, and they didn't do that. That was the maintenance staff's duty, and that's in the record.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.